Nina Simon speaks and people want to listen. She inspires, brings joy, invites you to go deeper and to think about things that matter for ourselves and for the planet. Nina's latest book, Nature, Culture, and the Sacred, A Woman Listens for Leadership, is the perfect book for this historical moment, a moment when the division between feminine and masculine is being redefined. Nina is all about allowing each of us to become fully human again. She invites us to be inspired by women who are leading the way towards transformational change by cultivating vibrant movements for social and environmental justice. She has listened to the call for her journey and will help you check in to make sure you are listening for yours. I can assure you that's what happened for me. Hello, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. And I am really honored to have Nina Simons as a return guest with us today for many reasons. Nina's book got me. It wrapped itself around my very being from the first few sentences, and it never let go. There are so many, many changes going on in our world, everywhere in our world. And unbeknownst to me, Nature, Culture, and the Sacred came to me at a time when I desperately needed it, at a time when, because of what is going on in our world, I felt the darkness wanting to come into my soul and wanting to take up permanent residence. But Nina's thoughtful, soulful, no-holding-back insights into her personal journey as someone called to lead was and will continue to be just the food that I need for my very tired soul at times. Her book made it very clear to me that leadership is more about finding the place where each of our unique gifts and talents connect with a real need for reinvention in this world of ours. And now we get to hear from Nina. Nina, thanks for being here. And I am so looking forward to spending this time with you.
Oh, thank you, Gina. That was a beautiful introduction. I'm really honored. Thanks.
And well deserved. So let's start with the macro, and then we're going to go to the micro. And it's out there. The book is out there. It's already impacting people's lives. And I just wanted to ask you, how would you describe the book? Because it's interesting for me when people ask me the question, why was it so important for you to write it in this particular time? And what's it about?
Oh, gosh. Well,
that's a big, bold question.
It's a great question. It really summarizes a lot of my learning, Gina, over the last 10 years or so. And really, since I got involved, well, I got involved with women's leadership and with what gender has to do with anything more than 10 years ago, probably 25 years ago. But the book just really wanted to happen now, partly to summarize what I've been learning over the last 10 years and really as an invitation to reframe and redefine leadership, as you said really beautifully in your intro, to also kind of make the case for why women's leadership is so important at this time. And to do it in a way that recognizes that we're all on a steep learning curve. We're in a moment of time when everything is up for review, including gender. And when, in fact, it's not just women's leadership, it's everyone's leadership that's needed now. But I think women have a particular set of gifts to offer to this time and to the reinvention of leadership. And so, the book traces the arc of my own journey from some poetic reflections on why women and what women have to offer to a more linear kind of making the case for women's leadership all over the world, to my journey into racial equity and diversity and justice and how that has been informing my sense of purpose over the last many years. And so it's really just an invitation for anyone who feels called to contribute to this moment of change. That's what I meant it to be anyway, and also to capture whatever I've learned in the last 10 years that could be useful to other folks.
Well, I'll be carrying it with me. When that darkness comes in, it's like, oh yeah, I think I need to read that part in Nina's book. And I certainly don't say that lightly. It's challenging to be alive and awake in these times. At least it is for me. But one of the things that struck me in reading the book is that you not only shared your journey, but what you did with your stories and with events that happened to you to create opportunities that created the space for others to lead. And of course, I couldn't do a show with you without asking you to talk about Bioneers, because I like to describe Bioneers to people as something you think you're going to, which then transforms you into something you become, because that's what happens for me and for my team. We're starved for it because we need that soul filling, as I call it. We need people to pour it in on us about what they're doing. So how did Bioneers come about, and how did it change the course of your life?
Oh my gosh. Well, Bioneers, for those folks who may not know it, is a nonprofit organization that produces a very large annual conference each year, and also a lot of media and podcasts and award-winning radio and videos out of those proceedings. And it started actually way back in 1990. So this is our 30th anniversary. And Bioneers really began when my husband and I were collaborating to run a biodiversity seed company. And we were both learning on a very steep learning curve about biodiversity and bioremediation, which is the use of natural systems to clean up the water and air and soil. And my husband, Kenny Ossibel, is an investigative journalist. And he was, as we were learning so much, he was finding all these amazing people that no one had ever heard of, and he thought they were extraordinary and important. And they were people who had looked into the heart of natural systems to learn how to reinvent our society and our culture in ways that don't destroy our future. And that included the wisdom of Indigenous people, who in many ways were the first pioneers. And so the way Bioneers actually got started was that Kenny was taking a hot tub with a friend who was an investor in our seed company. And Kenny was telling him about all these amazing folks and saying, people really need to know about them. And the friend said, why don't you have a conference? And Kenny said, I've never been to a conference. It sounds boring. Why would I do that?
It's like, true. I can hear Kenny saying that. I've never been to a conference. Right? When I read that, I was like, what? But I believed it.
And the friend actually gave him a check and said, have a conference. And Kenny came to me because he knew that I had a theater background. And I also had never been to a conference. So neither of us had any unlearning to do about the weird, boring, academic, stifled ways that traditional conferences were happening. And so we got to invent it from the get-go, and Kenny came to me and he said, will you help me make this conference? And at first I thought it sounded a little sciencey to me, and I wasn't sure it was really my cup of tea, but I helped him produce the first conference. And I remember sitting there, Gina, and just with my mouth hanging open and thinking, this is the community of people whose voices and visions I want to serve with my communication skills. And I was so excited and so electrified by it. And so together we've been producing this conference. We did it for the first 8 years on top of our day jobs without getting paid, basically as an act of love. And then just when we were utterly exhausted and about ready to call it quits, a visionary philanthropist came along and said, this encompasses everything I care about, so I'm going to give you a big grant. So give me a 5-year plan and don't ask too low. And that was the beginning of Bioneer's second phase of life. And now it's an annual conference in October that attracts between 3,000 and 4,000 people. It addresses people who have visionary and practical solutions basically for reinventing how we live on Earth. and they come from all walks of life, and they encompass women's leadership and youth leadership and racial equity and education and economy and politics and you name it, you know, and ecology, of course. And so many people come and either say, this is the first time in my life I feel like I've found my tribe, or one of my favorite responses is from young people. You know, we have a very active youth program. It's about 20% of our entire audience and are between the ages of 13 and 23. And they often come up to me at the conference and they say, before this, I couldn't imagine any way that I could make a living and contribute in a meaningful way to what's happening on Earth. And now I feel like I have 10 options and 10 people to follow up with, and I'm so excited.
And so it's so real. Yeah. That's so real what happens. And one of the things I love that I have to share is you do have some big names that have really what I would call made it on certain world stages. Lots of them come to mind, but you also still have and retain the integrity of the unheard voices or the person that's not famous. And what I love, I remember you had one guy, and I think his name was Bren, who did the vertical fishing in...
Bren Smith,
I thought that was his name, and loved him, interviewed him on the show. 3 years later, I'm sitting there and I'm watching 60 Minutes. And I say to my family, they're so yesterday. Bioneers had them on the stage 3 or 4 years ago. And Janine Banyas, she was on. And I went, really? Wow. I'm glad mainstream media has finally picked up on the important work that she's doing. And I get a kind of a big, you know, smile on my face saying, yeah, I was part of that. And hearing 16-year-olds without a skip in a beat, stand up there and blast it out in front of 3,000 or 4,000 people. I mean, I get goosebumps just talking about it. So that's how you turned that whole knock-knock into look at what's happening. And it's a perfect segue because the next one, and as I was reviewing this, I thought, holy smokes, not only did she do that for the world, she did it for me because now I'm a Bioneers junkie. And we interview so many people that we meet at Bioneers. So then we're going to talk about cultivating women's leadership, which is, I can't do a show without talking about that. But you changed my life in ways that maybe I didn't want to be changed and hope that I would never have to face this. And you write about it in your book, and we have to talk about it because it shocked me. And that was the whole thing about the burning times. And I admit this, and I know I'm not alone. I have asked, you know, maybe not hundreds, but so many women, do you know about the burning times? And they don't because the story isn't told. And you said it changed the course of your life. Well, you can be damn sure it changed the course of mine. So talk about the burning times. It shattered me for a while.
Well, you know, the good news about the burning times is that there was a film, a documentary film made in 1993, I think, by a Canadian woman filmmaker, literally called The Burning Times. And you can look it up on the internet, and you can actually watch it online for free. It's about an hour-long film, and it's not perfect, and it's a little dated, but what happened for me in the early 90s was that I got turned on to that film, and I took it home, and and when it was over, I felt like I had to watch it again because I was so blown open by it. And the more that I watched it, the more I got drawn into doing research about it because I couldn't believe that what I was learning was true. And basically, the burning times refers to a period in European history between the years of about 1300 and 1700, which was also during the Inquisition, which was a time where the Catholic Church went on a rampage, and basically somewhere, depends which historian you believe, somewhere between tens of thousands and millions of women and elder women and girls and some men as well, were systematically persecuted and tortured and often burned at the stake for the supposed crime of being witches. And when I learned about that, I said, wait a minute, this is a huge event in human history. And with so many of us, myself included, having some European, and this story has to exist in my bones because, you know, a 400-year war against women and the feminine is a pretty big deal. And basically what it means is that seven generations of children saw their mothers and aunties and sisters and grandmothers persecuted and tortured and killed. And what I learned about it when I researched it was that at the beginning of the Burning Times, there were actually more women than men in Europe. And by the end of the Burning Times, of course, that had changed. At the beginning of the Burning Times, women owned more wealth in Europe than men, and during the Burning Times, there was a tremendous transfer of wealth and power. At the beginning of the Burning Times, people's connection to the earth and paganism and rituals that connected them to earth cycles were very strong. But by the end of the Burning Times, they had been largely driven underground. And there were also transfers in medical systems. So at the beginning of the Burning Times, the women were the healers and the midwives and the hospice workers. And those women were the first to be persecuted. And by the end of the Burning Times, only men were allowed to practice medicine. And you had to go to medical school, and only men were allowed into medical school. And at the beginning of the Burning Times, the land was held as a commons for a village. But by the end of the Burning Times, it had all been privatized, and something called the enclosure movement had happened. So, and then I learned that it wasn't just in Europe, but that there were versions of this that happened in the Caribbean and in South America and in Africa and all over the world. And what I began to realize, Gina, was that I had been doing Bioneers for several years, and I was very increasingly aware of the kinds of social and environmental challenges that we face. And what I began to understand because of the Burning Times was that for me, those challenges can all be seen as an imbalance of the masculine and the feminine, not just in terms of women getting equal pay or equal opportunity, but in terms of the archetypal essence of the masculine and the feminine that exist in all human beings and in all of our institutions and our policies and our culture. So what I saw was that we had been through this giant sort of inversion that happened during the Burning Times, and that this masculinized way of seeing the world and of relating to it and of making laws and governance and policies was at the root of much of the suffering in the world and much of what was heading us in the wrong direction and in a direction that really threatened our collective future and the future of life on Earth. So it became a really pivotal moment for me, and I would encourage anyone who doesn't know about it to learn about it, because even though it's upsetting, you know, there's more and more science that epigenetically we carry some sort of ancestral memory in our bodies of trauma, and that indigenous people are carrying the trauma of their parents and grandparents, and people of African American descent are often carrying the trauma of their ancestors who were brought here as slaves. And so in many ways, I think that as women, we're all carrying trauma. I think that as human beings alive on the planet right now, we're all traumatized by the accelerated rate of change and loss and power abuse that we're witnessing and experiencing, and that therefore we need to show up for each other to help transform who we are internally as well as our systems and our structures. And that's what I would say about.
And that's like when I read it, when I saw it, it just, it does come into your cells, your cellular level, and you're first in disbelief. And they didn't just torture and burn and all that. They burned all of their journals and their medical records of history, of healing. And I mean, it's so in me that when Emily, our youngest daughter, was having her baby a month ago, I was sitting there talking to the midwife, and you know, we had a long time to talk because she had a very long labor. And I said, it just blows me away to think that there was a time in history when you would have gotten burned for doing that. And she was from one of the tribes, from one of the Pueblos mm-hmm. in Taos. And mm-hmm. she knew. She said, yeah, I know. So it's a perfect segue when you talk about deep inquiry in the role of gender in your life and the stories that you told yourself are self-limiting. You know, we use the phrase going deeper, and I talk about listening to our inner voices. And I have a committee, and I call it the committee, and I say to them sometimes, can you just please be quiet, because you're all talking at once when I have angst or whatever. And talk a little bit about not just the importance of listening to that, but quieting a lot of the voices that might be labeled negative, and listening, a deeper kind of listening, because that's why I started Mrs. Green's World. It was not in my long-term plan, not a part of my career preparing me for this. And I had to figure out how to listen and go to the rainforest. It was a critical time for me to spend time in what I call the quiet. Can you just reflect on that a little bit? Because there's so much noise out there, as you say, and trauma. Help us. How do you go quiet in this very noisy world?
Well, let's see. I would say that my life has taught me and continues to teach me that listening is one of the most important things I can practice. And I think of that partly because our culture, which again is so influenced by celebrating the masculine and denigrating the feminine, our culture teaches us to be perfectionist and to know the answers and to talk a lot more than we listen. And so I love that you describe your committee, Gina, because I sometimes refer to the chorus of Ninas. Yeah. You know, I also have a group of voices, and I'm learning to honor them and to actually practice listening for them so that I can be in attunement with their best counsel. I believe that we all carry a spark of the divine within us. And no matter what your spirituality or religious beliefs might be, you know, I think that that may be acceptable to almost anybody in almost any kind of spirituality. I think of it as sort of a secular spirituality that says the earth is sacred, and we are products of the earth, so we all carry the sacred within us. And so I have a practice of listening deeply, which is why I titled the book the way that I did, because I feel like I'm always listening to learn. And I hope that I'm never done learning and becoming who I'm meant to be until the day I die. And one practice that I have that I love, actually, I do some workshop teaching with a wonderful collaborator named Deborah Eden Tull. And together we offer workshops on something that she has developed called relational mindfulness. And we're doing one workshop this summer at Esalen and another one that's just for women, actually, in Southern Colorado in September. And each of them are about leading from relational mindfulness. And really, you know, what that's about is saying we are in a process as human beings of shifting from a worldview that's based on things and nouns to a worldview that's based on relating and connection. And that's very different. You know, our old civilization, which we can see crumbling and perverting all around us, is based on greed and accumulation. And, you know, in the Cherokee language, there is no word for love of an object. If you love an object, you're considered insane. But if you love something that's alive, now that makes sense. And in an indigenous worldview, which is one of my sources of inspiration, because really they're the people who are the original pioneers, the people who have lived on this land the longest and know how to live in right relationship to themselves, each other, and the earth. In that worldview, we're all relatives. And Bioneers actually says the same thing. You know, I am a relative of trees and of the gophers and of the crows and of the winds and of the rivers. And if you treat your relatives with respect, they take care of you back. So I am just in a practice of listening for guidance. And relational mindfulness is about quieting the mind enough to really listen, and to listen both inwardly and outwardly. And, you know, the premise of our teaching together is that listening better, both to ourselves and to the world and to each other, makes us better leaders. And I mean leaders in the new sense, like you described, Gina, which means anyone who is applying their gifts in whatever way, whether it's parenting or, you know, growing a garden or helping out at your kids' school or whatever it is, right? There are a million different ways, as Rumi said, to kneel and kiss the earth. And so listening for guidance about how to bring ourselves best to this moment of massive reinvention.
So
does that answer your question?
It so answers my question. And what happened for me with reading the book is I was having like a whirling dervish moment with one of my best friends and saying, you know, I don't have work-life balance and I have so many meetings and I'm so tired of being up at night, out at night, blah, 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 blah. And she is a really good friend. She's a woman. She said, get back to your meditation, Gina. Start every day off with that because it calms you down. And why I want to share that is because what meditation looks like for me, it's not some deep-seated, lights-off, feet-on-the-ground, darkness, timed event. Every morning, and reading your book, I mean, darn it, it helped me go right back on that path. I go outside, which you can still do in Tucson, another miracle. It has to be early. And Nina, all I do is sit there pretty much with a smile on my face. Every morning, the hummingbird comes and says hello to me. The bees are out there. The birds are chirping. The mountains are in my face. And I say, how do I want to show up today? What do I want today to be like? And that's meditation. That's getting quiet. Yeah. It's not, it doesn't have to be this heavy play music, kumbaya, which didn't work for me. I had to go to a very different place to have it work. And that's what you say in the book. It's showing up as you, not as an instruction booklet. And I think that's really important. Find your voice.
Exactly. And I do something very similar, Gina. And part of what I do, I mean, nature is my sense of the sacred.
Right.
So all I have to do is open my eyes and go, holy cow, look how gorgeous.
Right.
Look how resilient and amazing this is. And then I take a quick moment to close my eyes and go, how's my body this morning? How's my heart doing? And wait and listen and check in. And how's my mind this morning? And what's my spirit or my soul feeling like? Because then I've checked in with all my four octaves of being. And then I can show up in a more whole way. There isn't a right and wrong about it.
Right.
But the truth is, as you say, we're all being bombarded with so much information and so much distraction. And my gosh, if I'm not in touch with myself, how can I bring myself in a good way to the world?
What I used to do, Nina, wake up, turn on my phone, and check my emails. How much better is it that I go out in the backyard and we have so many birds and it's so quiet where I live? Mm-hmm. It's like it's transformative. So for people that want to get help, as I did, just spend time in the quiet. And that's what it means to me, just really and truly outside or whatever. So this is, I was thinking about the name for the show. It should be like Nina Teaches Gina, because it has such a ring to it. But we have to go to cultivating women's leadership, because, you know, I was working on the question and type and retype and edit. And what happens that you do is it comes to you, and that as many other women leaders do, and as I am doing, that's the part that I had to own, as I am doing in my part of my walk, is you share. So you got together a group of women, skillful facilitators that know about group transformative processes, you gathered them, and you co-created a six-day, and I'm talking about deep dive, immersion training into leading from the feminine. And I was I'm laughing because I was truly blessed to be able to go. And this morning, the second thing I did was connect with everyone of my group from 5 years ago on WhatsApp, because we all stay together, we connect, we go to each other's homes from all over the world. And so that transformed me, continues to unfold. So how would you describe cultivating women's leadership? Because I sure as heck can't. Can you do it justice?
Well, you know, Gina, I would opt not to spend a lot of time on that.
Okay.
Because cultivating women's leadership is no longer being offered in that form. So you were very lucky to be among the last.
Was I ever?
But what I would say is that all of us who were involved in developing and evolving it, it was a six-day deep dive into leading from the feminine, clarifying your own sense of purpose, and connecting across differences with women who you might not have an opportunity to really befriend in our society that tends to segregate us so much. And I think that there are elements of that that are available at a Bioneers conference. And also, each of us, myself and Toby Hertzlick, is continuing to do beautiful deep dive women's retreats based on biomimicry, and I'm doing other workshops. So the work is continuing in other forms. And I think it's a lot of why I also wrote the book, was to capture some of what I had learned from that. And hopefully that's in the book.
It's in the book. It's in the book.
Good.
And style, yeah, Styles of Leadership. But it's to me, I guess the takeaway is you acted on it. You dared greatly, as our dear friend, who I wish was my personal friend, Brené Brown says, you dared greatly and started something that the likes of which I've never seen. And when Kenny said he never went to a conference, it's not a conference, it's a gathering, a transformational gathering. So let's swift, in the time that we have left, let's talk about climate change. All over the world, the most marginalized communities are experiencing the impacts of climate change in significant ways already. Newsflash, people. Climate change is not coming, it's happening. Extreme starvation from drought, millions of people that are climate refugees, the list goes on. Lack of access to clean water, loss of habitat because of deforestation, rising sea levels. And we know that it hits marginalized communities first and hardest. What kind of role do you believe, having spent so much time learning from and participating with Indigenous people and those leaders, what do you believe the role for Indigenous people that they have to play and continue to play in the climate movement? Is their participation essential from your perspective?
Oh, of course. Yes, I think that their not only their participation, but their leadership is essential. But I also believe that the leadership of young people and the Sunrise Movement and of women of color-led movements and of women's movements in general is also essential. I think we are facing a time when the intractability of the oil and gas companies and the current systems that are entrenched and holding on for dear life are only going to be changed if enough of us take to the streets. And honestly, I think that it is the leadership of women, of Indigenous people, of women of color-led movements, and of youth movements that's going to make the biggest difference. You know, I saw a TED Talk recently that quite blew me away by a woman who was a historian who had started out believing that only aggression and violence were what changed governance. And she spent 2 years studying the history of the last 200 years, and it completely toppled her worldview. And what she found was that nonviolent direct action, people going and demonstrating in the streets, were time and time again what had transformed policies and governments. And that it only took, according to her research, 3.5% of the population showing up. And not everybody is a direct action activist. I'm certainly not. I've not been arrested, and I have no real intention of doing so. You know, but as she puts it, people who are young, people who are older, people who are disabled, I think climate change is the mother of all issues. And I think that our healthcare and our water and our breathable air and our food supply and our systems of inequity are all tied together. They're all one giant system. And I think the only way it's going to change is by enough of us getting out on the streets and participating with Indivisible and lobbying our congresspeople and our representatives and our senators. And I think that's what's going to change it, honestly.
So, case in point, it blew me away that the series of events in Hong Kong, because I got news for you, I was not thinking the outcome was going to be as it would. 1 million people and everything that you described peacefully demonstrated and took to the streets. And when they announced, I think it was yesterday, that they're going to not change the policy or at least put it on hold. And I wanted to say, yeah, don't go to sleep over there because it's got such world news. So it's a perfect example of exactly what you're talking about. Flint, Michigan, mothers who never saw themselves in leadership roles, they're demanding clean water for their children and for themselves. Imagine that. And children are suing the federal government over climate change. 16-year-olds are leading entire movements about gun control. I mean, the list goes on, and it's your description of new models of leadership that I believe will continue to emerge and that are so important for our survival. And it's an exciting time.
It is. You know, it's funny, Gina, because the New York Times just did a report on a conference that they sponsored in New York a week ago, and it was all about gender and leadership. And what they're saying in the whole article that or series of articles that they produced is exactly what we've been talking about for a long time. They call it gender judo, that leaders need to be deploying the very best of their human qualities, whether they're from the masculine side, from the feminine side, and constantly be nimble enough to be integrating both in order to be the most effective leaders they can be. So they need to be relationally adept and also decisive and analytical and strategic, you know, and empathetic. And isn't that who we're all meant to be?
And it's just like, it's that going deeper part that just, you know, it kept resonating with me. I don't even like that term, but something inside of me was reverberating and saying, yes, yes, yes. So let's talk about
how... But, you know, Gina, can I just say something about
that? Absolutely.
Okay. I mean, I think, because you keep referring to going deeper, and I'm not completely sure what you mean, but I know what it means to me. And so I'll just say something about
that. That was one of my questions. It's like, Nina, what do you mean by that? And I know that we don't have the 3.5 hours that I want to have. So that is a term that I think we need to talk about and take as much time as you want, because I shouldn't throw that term out without clarifying it.
Well, I'll tell you what it means to me is that I believe that as human beings, we were endowed with emotions for very good reason, that nature evolved us to have emotions, for each of them to be able to be sources of information for us. And an example of that is, that I believe anger is our body's way of telling us that a boundary has been trespassed. And if you think about how every newborn baby is now born with well over 200 chemicals not found in nature already in their bodies, if that isn't trespassing a boundary, I don't know what is, right? So we have very good reason to be angry because the corporations run amok, who are really in many ways controlling our governance and our leadership through their greed and destructive tendencies, are poisoning our bodies and our land and our water and our air. And in addition to, of course, accelerating climate change. So for me, and the other thing is that being alive at this time when scientists are talking about a million species going extinct, like that's just not some vague out there conceptual term to me. I find that deeply upsetting and grievous and painful. And that's a reality that, you know, whether we're fully aware of it or not, I think we're all living with today. And so I think part of the legacy of a patriarchal culture has been to tell us that positive emotions are, quote, good, and, quote, negative emotions are bad. And we shouldn't feel depressed or sad or angry or grieve. We should be happy and perfect. And guess what? That's not who we are. That's not the truth of our beings. And so, you know, you were just talking about your daughter giving birth and being in labor. As women, I think we are designed to have cycles that connect us with the earth and the cosmos. You know, any woman who has had a menstrual cycle knows that, you know, oftentimes if we're with other women, we get synced up with their cycles. And if we're really in balance, what I found when I was having my cycles was that I would get synced up with the moon cycles. And I loved that. Like that was how, one of the ways I knew when I was balanced and really grounded and connected to the earth. And so, you know, I think that we have in us, because we are biologically designed to be able to give birth, and because there is a history of women being midwives and hospice workers and caregivers, we have a capacity to be present with life cycles in a way that is in our bodies. And I believe that as women, we need to reclaim all of our human capacities to be our strongest, most resilient, and most joyful selves. And one of my favorite reference points comes from Alice Walker, who said that the way her way of relating to grief was that the deeper she could go in allowing herself to be sad or grieving was correlated to the amount of joy she could experience. And so my sense is we have to reclaim our relationship to the underworld. We have to reclaim our relationship to all our emotions. And that actually, while it may be difficult, I believe it makes us stronger and wholer human beings. And that ultimately, I don't know about yours, but my soul craves that kind of depth. And I think that it's part of the reason we have such an epidemic of depression in our world, is because our society has told us we're not allowed to be sad and we're not allowed to grieve. And guess what? If we don't get sad and grieve, we can't bring our whole selves to this moment. And I don't think we can experience the kind of wholehearted joy that I want in celebrating the magnificence of life on Earth at the same time as we're bringing ourselves to these difficult and painful realities. So that's what I mean about going deep.
And have I got a perfect quote from you, and it's out of a great book from Joanna Macy, a beloved mentor to so many. In your book, you write, "She showed me that when we open our hearts to the overwhelming suffering in our world and we face the pain and let ourselves grieve fully, we not only become more complete human beings, we become far more effective in doing good because we are then able to place our pain within a larger context that gives us meaning. And then the upside is that it actually reconnects us to our sense of joy." I mean, I underlined that, scored it, put stars around it, asterisks. It's like, yes, because sometimes I don't want to feel that pain. I don't want to go there. And yeah. I don't want to see the news tonight because I can't handle it. But that connection has to happen to give us the larger context. Okay, so there's two more questions I have to ask you, even though I have 10 more. And it's okay. I guess the one I want to talk about is the next to last question is what I would call the healing. Because what I believe is that before we can move forward in this country especially, before we can get to a place of real equity and inclusion, before we can really create those new paradigms of leadership, there have to be conversations, deep conversations, challenging, authentic conversations about forgiveness and healing. And that, my friend, has come about as a result of having some of those conversations. I think of an interview I did with a man named Xavier Ramey. He said, "White people have to acknowledge what they did and say they're sorry." Those were his words on my show. And he speaks all over the world and has a company called Justice Informed. And it doesn't have to look exactly like that. But what are your thoughts on an acknowledgement? And it's like we can't act like none of that happened. Look what we've done and continue to do to Indigenous people and Black people. We can't just move on.
No, I agree. I, you know, the more that I am learning about racial equity and justice and healing, the more that I am understanding that there have to be ceremonies, whether they're one-on-one or in a larger public context, of reparations and acknowledgement for the harm and healing and perhaps forgiveness. You know, what I'm seeing, Gina, that gives me great heart is that there are ceremonies that are happening now. I know people who are descendants of people who did great harm to Indigenous people. And they have written letters of apology to the descendants of the people they did great harm to. There is a large-scale ceremony of forgiveness that's happening with a Lakota chief and many other people in early July, because there are descendants of Custer's army and of General Custer and of the people who made the rifles that were used to demolish large swaths of Lakota people back at Custer's last stand. And they have written to this Lakota elder saying they want to ask forgiveness and they want to offer reparations. And there are ceremonies like that that are starting to happen, and they're happening first in the invisible world, but they're also happening. You know, I just heard about a woman, a congresswoman from Texas, who's introduced a bill to start talking about creating an investigative panel to look into what would reparations for slavery look like. Because the truth is, we are all products of a racist culture. Whether any of us is individually racist or not is not even the point.
Exactly.
You know, one of my teachers says, I have racism coming out of my pores and I can't help it. And I have to be humble about that and real about it and ask my friends who are people of color to bear with me and you know, reflect to me if I screw up, because we all do. So I do think that there is a way that we have to recognize what white privilege is, which is based on white supremacy. And of course, she wrote a book that's great called White Fragility. And understand that when somebody speaks about this stuff, we don't have to get defensive. We have to be able to be strong enough in our own roots to be able to hear someone else's pain and empathize and care and not get defensive, because it's not necessarily us individually that did it. Recognize that it's the system that has done it, but that we have the opportunity as people with extra amounts of privilege and power in this culture to help change it. And that's one of the most exciting opportunities I can think of.
It's the new paradigm for leadership. So I have one last question and then my last words. I'd like to leave on such an up note, and it's about storytelling, about the power of storytelling. Your book is a story of your stories, of other women's stories. Why do you think that each of us figuring out how to tell our stories, or do you think it's so vitally important when it comes to being a part of creating and shaping this new paradigm that so many of us want to be a part of? I mean, you describe many incidents of it in the book, but for the thousands of people that will listen to this podcast, that we all have stories, and they'll come out in different ways. So why do you think it's so important that we try to figure out what our story is and how to tell it?
Well, that's a great question, Gina, and I love that you're asking it. You know, in all the years of teaching women's leadership, one of the things that I've learned is that all these amazing women who are each leading change in their own ways would come to those retreats saying, I'm not sure I belong here. I don't think I qualify as a leader. And I realized we all have a collective story that we're not enough. And when I think back on the messages of the earlier waves of the feminist movement, where they said the personal is political, I think that that's at the heart of why our stories are so important. There's also research that has shown now, it's a research by a cognitive linguist who says that if you have wrapped your heart around a story, no amount of facts is going to get you to let go of that story. Only a more compelling story will get you to let go of it and change your vision, your perspective. And there's a great example of this, which folks can look up actually in the New York Times within the last week. Some may have heard of Representative Pramila Jayapal, and that's spelled J-A-Y-A-P-A-L. She is an extraordinary woman of color who is a congresswoman from the state of Washington. And she wrote an op-ed in the New York Times in the last week about her own experience of having to choose an abortion because it would have threatened her life to have had another child. And because of the difficulties she experienced in her first child's birth and subsequent life. And it was such a courageous and beautiful outpouring where, you know, suddenly the issue of abortion, which people tend to dig in their heels about and have strong opinions about. And this was such a humanizing story where you really could empathize with this woman's terrible, hard choice, but how grateful she was that she had the choice, because she might have died otherwise. And she simply knew she wasn't ready. In spite of having used birth control, she got pregnant and she knew she wasn't ready to have another child. And it's so beautiful because she's received thousands of letters from people all over the country saying, thank you for telling your story. And it's the kind of thing where so often we have a little voice inside our heads that say, oh, my story's not important. But guess what? It is. I promise you it is. And there's something about claiming our own truth and our own voice and doing that in the form of storytelling, whether it's in a circle that you're in or over a dinner party or however you choose to do it or in a letter to the editor, that actually helps humanize these things that I think it's part of the legacy of a patriarchal culture, that we relate to things conceptually but not in an embodied, empathetic way. And stories bring it all home to the heart. And that's why I think telling our stories and owning our stories and the value of our stories is so important.
And what a note on which to take a deep breath And then let me get the last word. And you know how that tickles me, Nina, to just me. I love that it's, I get to do the last word. There's something inside of me that has a need for that, obviously, because I want to press pause. But I have added this to the show and I've gotten feedback about it because people want to hear, well, what do you think, Gina? So here are my last words about the impact of reading Nature, Culture, and the Sacred, A Woman Listens for Leadership. Read it. Savor it. Process the messages you will find in it that touch your heart. Awaken a voice or voices within you. Share it. Start a women's group to help each other go deeper, and even consider inviting women into it who might not share your views or beliefs. Why read it? Because we're living in one of the most transformational times in human history. Because what is at stake is our survival, not Mother Earth's survival, because she will survive the ravages of climate change. Because it's important that each of us find our voices for ourselves to awaken our own vision and to help create a world that works for everyone. To even believe that that kind of world is possible, reading this book will help you keep that dream, that hope, that vision alive. It'll help you find your true north. I believe that we all need to do better to support a healthy, sustainable, and socially just planet. I also believe that the journey will continue to be a long and sometimes painful one. Nina's book will help you to know better and then do better. And let us never forget that we need to take time to celebrate doing better and making a bigger difference together. Thanks, everyone, for being a part of my world. And Nina, I shall be forever grateful for you showing up in mine.